You're listening to a podcast of Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Write the Book airs every Monday at 2 on the Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. The show features interviews with authors, poets, agents, editors, and others who build a life around books. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Anjali Miterduva, author of the novel Faint Promise of Rain. Anjali Miterduva is a writer who grew up in France and has family roots in Calcutta, India. After completing graduate studies at MIT and launching a career in urban planning, she found the call of storytelling too great to resist. A switch to freelance writing and project management allowed her more time for her own creative pursuits. Her debut novel, Faint Promise of Rain, came out recently from She Writes Press. She's a co-founder of Chandika, an organization that teaches and presents India's classical storytelling Kathak dance. Anjali lives near Boston with her husband and two daughters and is at work on her second novel, set in 19th century Lucknow. Here's a little information about Faint Promise of Rain. It is 1554 in the desert of Rajasthan, an outpost of resistance against a new Mughal emperor. In a family of Hindu temple dancers, a daughter, Adhira, must carry on her family's sacred tradition. Her father, against his wife and son's protests, insists Adhira marry the temple deity and give herself to a wealthy patron. But after one terrible evening, she makes a brave choice that carries her family's story and their dance to a startling new beginning. Told from the memory of this exquisite dancer and filled with the sounds, sights, and flavors of the Indian desert, this is the story of a family and a girl caught between art, duty, and fear in a changing world. Faint Promise of Rain is shortlisted for the 2016 William Saroyan International Prize for Writing, as well as for a 2015 Chaucer Award for Historical Fiction. When I spoke with Anjali Miterduva, I began by asking her to read from Faint Promise of Rain.
Adhira, 1611. In Rajasthan, where I was born, a child of five is likely never to have seen rain. For hundreds of years, the monsoons have been elusive. In the children's rooms in the royal palace, not far from what used to be my family's home, the walls are painted with black and blue cloud designs, so the little ones will not be afraid when the skies finally break open. But for less fortunate children, such as my brothers and sister, the day of their first rain can mean an intensity of both fear and hope. And for adults whose lives are connected to the rhythms and cycles of beliefs they cannot always explain, these storms can signify both portent and promise. So when the skies darkened and the heavy drops fell as I was born, it is no wonder that some considered it a sign that I had been chosen. Of course, I began, as all children do, accepting my lot in life. It was the only life I knew, ruled by the decisions of my father, dance master at the temple to Lord Krishna, just outside the citadel of Jaisalmer. When I was old enough, I began to understand, contrary to what he'd told me, that I could have a hand in creating my own path. And although I struggled greatly along the way, the deities must have approved of my choices. For many, many years later, they made me special after all. I'm not sure why they acted as they did, or how they chose what knowledge to grant me and what to keep concealed. But I was given insight into the thoughts and feelings of others. Was it a moment of selfishness on the part of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva? Was it for our dance? I cannot presume that it was just for me. Whatever the reason, I came, in hindsight, to know the minds and hearts of some of those closest to me when I was a child, a knowledge that allows me to tell this story. It is not my story alone, therefore, but it is mine alone to tell.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for reading that. So many stories begin out of great events in weather, natural disasters, floods, droughts, earthquakes, tsunamis, and your book begins in some ways out of rain or out of a drought and then rain. So I wonder if you can talk about, I don't know if you've ever thought about that catastrophic weather inspires story, but also how you were inspired to write this book.
So that's an interesting point. I mean, I think in terms of catastrophic weather, it's a universal thing, and it leads to all kinds of stories. I mean, you think of all the stories, real and then inspired by, that came out of Katrina, for example.
Right.
Or the 2004 tsunami in East Asia. So I hadn't really thought of it that way. I don't necessarily think of this rain as catastrophic in a sense.
No, right. No, the drought.
Mysterious. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. So the inspiration, did come, that little image is something that I read in 2001 when I was planning a trip to India where I had been many times as a child. My father being Indian, I had traveled a lot to India over the course of my childhood. But in 2001, I wanted to take my husband, who was not, had never been to India. And I was looking at a guidebook in the days before TripAdvisor. And in this Michelin guidebook, I read, it was a guidebook specifically about Rajasthan, which is in the northwest part of India where my book is set. And it's a part of India that really captured my imagination when I went there in my teens, or when I was about 12, I think. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to take him there and to go back for myself. It's a land of palaces and citadels that just kind of rise up out of the desert. It's very striking. Mm-hmm. And it's a good entry point to India for people who have never been, because it doesn't have the teeming crowds of the big cities.
Okay.
So I was reading in this guidebook where to stay, and there was this anecdote or image that said exactly that in Rajasthan, in that part of Rajasthan, it's possible for a child to reach the age of 5 and never have seen rain. And it went on to say what I put in my book there, about painting black and blue cloud designs in the children's rooms in the palaces. And that just really struck me. I had no intentions of, or even thoughts of, writing a book, but I jotted that image down because I just wanted to, I don't know, capture it, keep it somehow.
Yes.
And it ended up becoming the one paragraph of my book that did not go through the 12 or 13 revisions that everything else went through.
That's interesting.
But it was sort of the kernel of what ended up being this book.
That's so interesting, because so many of the writers that I speak to say that their beginnings come at the end, or they start with a beginning and then that always changes. And actually, for myself as a writer, that's not how it goes. My beginnings often stay the same. So I'm sort of relieved to hear that you say that stayed.
Yeah, it was, it's odd. I feel like that means something. I'm not sure what,
yeah.
But that's where the heart of the story really began. And I kept it, and for many revisions, I kept thinking, am I doing one of those things where I should, you know, kill my darlings? Am I just too attached to it, and it's not actually serving the purpose to the story? And then I felt, no, that actually is, that is the beginning. That's how it starts.
Yeah, absolutely. I felt it was the perfect beginning. And I also think that it's not just about the fact that children might reach the age of 5 without ever having experienced rain, but also you go on to sort of amplify that they even, you know, paint their ceilings in a way that will make them imagine it, so that it's not frightening to them when it actually happens. That's all very vivid, and it just totally provoked my curiosity as a reader as I was starting.
Oh, good.
So yeah, absolutely. Now, one thing that anyone who just heard you read that will understand is you choose to write this novel, mm-hmm. Faint Promise of Rain, from Adhira's first person omniscient hindsight narrative, which I thought was so clever.
Thank you.
It was wonderful. I wondered how you arrived at this unique perspective for her.
That is a good question, and you're right that I arrived at it at the end of sort of a journey through puttering around with point of view, mm-hmm. And I ended up with something fairly unconventional, which can be a risk, you know, especially if this is a writer's first book. One is very much advised to not go break some rule.
Right, right.
So, because what I did was, she's only sort of partially omniscient, right? So she's not omniscient.
No.
Sort of what the right word is, but she can relate what some of the people around her were feeling and thinking, as she says. I started out the book I started out with what I think worked better in my head than on paper,
mm-hmm.
which was this idea that I wanted Adhira to be a sort of composite of how everybody else saw her, and then I wanted the reader to to make up his or her own kind of mind about her.
Okay.
So I started out writing each chapter as they are now, titled with the name of a character, and that character was a sort of close third person. Third person, but very focused on a specific character in each one.
Right.
And then through them, through those characters, we would get their perspectives on Adhira,
mm-hmm.
so that she would be, because she also symbolizes this whole art form and the whole dance. And so I did that. And then what happened, of course, was that I thought, well, there should be one place where her voice comes out. And so I put in one chapter that was her,
mm-hmm.
you know, her voice. And then I had a number of people read it, and pretty unanimously people said, I want more of Adhira. I want to know more about what she's thinking, what she's feeling. This is a very much a story about her. And I realized, I think, that I had just been being a coward. And I didn't want to deal. I didn't want to figure out how she felt. I was afraid of not knowing. And I think that happens to a lot of writers. You shy away from the thing that you actually should be writing.
Yeah.
And that ends up actually being probably the most interesting thing that your readers appreciate.
You talk about how, you know, you did something unconventional, but the truth is that we are used to reading a first-person point of view, so it's not as unique as something just like that we've never, you know, like when
right.
you know, when Jay McInerney did the second person perspective in Bright Lights, Big City, or Virgin Suicides was in the collective third we. So it didn't bump me out. It was just a really interesting way to give more insight into.
Mm-hmm.
her perspective, which I thought was great.
Yeah, I appreciate that you appreciated it. In the end, what happened is that I thought, all right, it's true, I need to give Adhira more of a voice, but I also felt it was important to maintain this idea of how everybody else sees her, because all the characters in the book, all her family members and people close to her, are basically all acting in what they think is a way that will protect her. But
mm-hmm.
they have different ideas of protect her from what and how and why. And I didn't think that could come through very well if I was strictly first person.
Right.
Sort of the standards first person.
Right. Before we go much farther into the interview, I think we should probably talk a little bit about Hindu temple dance and the Devadasis, is that how you say the name?
Correct, yeah, Devadasi.
Devadasi. Can you talk a little bit about what that is?
Absolutely. So India has a tradition of dancers who are affiliated or belong to, actually, temples. And the reason I alighted on this topic is that I actually studied, when I came back from that trip to through India and to Rajasthan that I was mentioning earlier, I came back to cold, snowy New England where I live in January, and I wanted to just recapture some of the warmth and vibrancy of where I had just been. And I had been thinking for a while to start an Indian dance class. I had done martial arts in the past, and I thought if I do something dance, which I'd never done, I'd never done any dance as a child, and I thought, well, if I try dance, I would like it to be something that has the same rich history and sort of cultural significance and discipline as the martial arts that I had been studying. And I knew about this dance form called Kathak, which is one of the seven, some say eight, classical forms of dance from India.
Okay.
And Kathak is from North India. And it's very much practiced and performed nowadays. K-A-T-H-A-K is how mm-hmm. it's spelled. And so when I started studying that dance form, which is beautiful, very percussive, and has, as you can tell if you read the book,
yeah.
you know, ankle bells and a lot of storytelling, its origins are in these temple dances. And so what would happen is, and we're talking, you know, 15th, 16th, 17th century, or even earlier, there would be young girls and women who were dedicated to a specific temple. And in India, because in Hinduism there are so many deities, you traditionally what happens is a temple is specifically dedicated to one deity.
Mm-hmm.
So in my book, it is a temple to Lord Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
And so these women would live at the temple, and some of them came as little girls. They were either given to the temple by their parents for a variety of reasons.
Right.
And others were born into, you know, they were born of a Devadasi, so their mothers were Devadasis. And they would live at the temple. There would be these dedicated quarters where they lived, and they would dance in honor, you know, to worship the deity. They would go into the city or town or village, and they would dance at events where they would bring good fortune, like at a birth or a wedding or coronation of a prince. But there was a flip side to this existence, mm-hmm. which was that when they came of age, to use a euphemism, when they reached puberty, there would be a kind of an auction almost, and wealthy men would bid, and whoever paid the highest would become the patron of this young girl, and the money went to the temple.
Mm-hmm.
To the upkeep of the temple and who knows what.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And so then she served as his, you know, sexual companion. So there was this fascinating dichotomy, or this two sides, where on the one hand these dancers were servants of God. That's what Devadasi means.
Right.
And when they were in that capacity dancing, they were considered vessels of the divine. They were considered, you know, representations of the divine on earth, and they were sacred. And you were not allowed to touch them, and there were all these rules. And they were very respected for that.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was this whole other side, right, where they were treated, they were abused, and they had no rights. And there are, you know, still flavors of those two sides in how women are treated, well, in a lot of parts of the world, but
mm-hmm.
still in India, where on the one hand women are viewed as the mother, you know, capital M sort of figure, and revered for that, but then also terrible violence is carried out on them. So that was part of the reason to write this book, is to sort of explore that world.
And so as you started doing this dance in, it sounds like, the early 2000s,
mm-hmm, correct.
Who did you study with? I mean, when you came back to New England, were there places to go and learn the dance, or did you study on your own?
So in classical Indian dance, because this dance, which has its roots in that world,
right,
changed a lot, you know, over the course of India's tumultuous history, and that is also why I'm writing four books, not just one, but I'm setting four
okay.
at different times of transition in India's history. And so now it's been, you know, it was influenced by Persian dance during the Mughal era, and so it's morphed a lot. It still has its essential storytelling side, but like any classical dance in India, the way you learn or study is you study with a teacher, and you study that lineage of teachings, because they're all oral traditions.
Okay.
So,
so it's very much like martial arts in that way.
Exactly, it's passed down,
yeah.
And compositions are passed down, and so there's, and if you're familiar with that world, you can start seeing. If you see a dancer, you can say, oh, that's the style of such and such teacher or guru, as they're known. And so so I studied, I came back to Massachusetts, and I Googled Kathak, and by complete coincidence, there was a teacher teaching literally down the street from me at this wonderful dance center,
wow.
the dance complex in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I could walk down to the studio.
That's amazing.
And I know, and I went in, and the class was run by a woman who was not Indian, a woman named Gretchen Hayden, and at first that gave me pause, and then I thought, well, that's silly, and so I went in, and I was completely smitten, because the studio was full of a lot of people of South Asian descent, and then a lot of, you know, a significant handful of non,
mm-hmm.
and which I liked the mix. And it turns out that she had started studying in the 70s in California with a teacher who had come from Calcutta, and his name was Chitresh Das, Pandit Chitresh Das, who, and that's all, this is actually the subject of one of my future books.
Okay.
It's another period of India's history, or the diaspora of the 1970s, a lot of people bringing a lot of traditional arts to the West, dance and Ayurvedic medicine, yoga, and finding a very willing and open audience in California, you know, in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, where these things really took root. And so he ended up teaching he studied as a child in Calcutta, and he grew up there, became, you know, very strong, talented dancer. And he came to the U.S., first to Maryland and then to California, and has a school. Well, he passed away, unfortunately, very suddenly last year, a year ago in January, at the age of 70. But after having created a whole school of 500 or 600 students in California, and also some in India, he went back to open a school there. So she, our teacher, Gretchen Hayden, studied from him, and she, in a sense, embraced the tradition almost more than some Indians would. You know, she completely, thoroughly did the whole, she sort of oriented her whole life towards studying this dance with him, becoming his disciple, traveling to India a lot, and so her classes have been completely the real deal, which brings up an interesting question of, you know, authenticity and authority and all kinds of things like that, which are of interest to me as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
although it really speaks to having the right teacher, you know.
It does.
It's so
completely
important.
Completely. So that's the lineage of teaching that I belong to.
Okay, and so apart from your own journey of learning the dances, I wondered about researching this book. I imagine it required a lot of research. There are the dances, the stories, the customs, the time period. Mm-hmm. And although you've been to India, I don't know, you know, did you ever live there? And so I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about your research process.
Sure. It was interesting. I think I ended up relying a lot on my previous experience as opposed to setting about to do specific research. I mean, I did some of that as well, but I did live in India for a short while when I was 12, 13, but we lived in Bombay, well, still known as Bombay at the time, Mumbai now, and but I had certainly grown up steeped in Indian culture, listening to a lot of Indian classical music, hearing these stories, which are, I mean, the stories of Hindu deities show up in, you know, comic books for kids, and in paintings, and in poetry, and in song, and so a lot of the stories are ones that I knew anyway. Even though I did not grow up in a religious household, they've become just kind of part of the culture. And then I relied a lot on my travels to Jaisalmer, because here's the thing. It's a citadel, and most of the external wall is still there. It still looks very much like a citadel, and it's a UNESCO World Heritage site. So there's very little that can be done to change the structure, and there are no cars allowed inside because the alleys and streets are very narrow. And so, honestly, if you take out the power lines and the cell phones, it looks the way it looked 500 years ago. So it was very easy to imagine the physical setting. And physical setting is incredibly important to me, especially as I have a background in urban planning.
Yes,
so I care a lot about those types of things. And the setting was there. I had been there, I had seen it, and there was no leap of imagination to set a story there. Another piece was just the dance. I could not have written this book without studying the dance, you know, learning the movements myself, learning the stories, being in the dance studio. And that ended up being, in a sense, research, although that's not why I started studying it.
Yeah.
And so then, of course, I had to fill in a lot of the history, which I researched, and a lot of the details, what bird might be there mm-hmm. and what season on its migratory passage from the Himalayas to wherever, or what type of flower grows. And I remember, because I have a scene with a horse, and I don't ride horses. And
so is this the scene when her brother rides the horse?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That was great.
So I looked online at a slow motion of a horse at a canter, at a gallop, because I was trying to match the patterns of the hooves on the ground with the certain dance
yeah.
composition. So that kind of thing you can get sucked into. Sometimes a little further than you anticipated.
Right. I always figure that if you're writing a historical book, the upside is if you're feeling like you can't write anything that day, you can do research. But the downside is if you could just get sort of sucked into your research. And
You can. For sure.
So actually, that brings me nicely to my next question for you, which is, can you talk about the extent to which Faint Promise of Rain is historical? What characters are based on historical figures, and which are completely from your own imagination? And, you know, how much overlap is there?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things for me about setting a story in Rajasthan is that is a part of the world where the line between, you know, history or fact or what really happened and myth or legend is very blurry, and which makes for a interesting mix, especially when you're setting a story about a storytelling form of dance.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of layers, but just as an example, if you were to go to Jaisalmer now, you'd see that there's a well in one of the central squares, which I think I bring up in the book. And the story of how that well, which is physically there now, how it came to be is that the story of its origin is in a myth in the great myth. Hindu epics of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. There's a story where a prince comes along, Prince Arjuna, who's you know, part of a story.
Right.
And he was a great archer, and he struck a rock with his arrow, and out of the rock sprang water. And a sage was passing through there, as they do in these stories, and prophesied because you need a prophecy, and prophesied that a prince would come along and set his capital city in this location. And sure enough, about 200 years later, a young prince named Prince Jaisal showed up and thought this was a good area, because it was a little raised up in the desert, to set a capital city, because he would have a good vista and be able to see his enemies approaching. And besides, there was water. And so he set his city, and he called it Jaisalmer, and there it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I took advantage to some extent of those blurred lines. And in terms of what was really true was the historical context of Akbar coming to the throne as a Mughal emperor at the age of 13, and the uncertainty of what was going to happen under Muslim rule. In what was then called Hindustan. And so the overall context is, you know, as historically accurate as I could figure. But the family, the characters, the individual characters are all made up completely. Their characters, I thought, might be, you know, would be living in those times and doing what they're doing, but they're based on my imagination.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Great. Do you mind if I read a little tiny bit and then ask you about it?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Adhira's father is named Bapu, and this is a chapter from her mother's perspective. Girija. Is that how you say that?
Girija.
Girija. Okay.
Yep.
At this point, the father, Bapu, is rearranging the cushions on the floor and then lifted the rug in the eating area, beat it with his hand, and placed it back down. Ma winced. That area was for her husband to sit in and rest and eat the food she brought him. It was not his place to perform such a household chore. And yet, she sat rooted to the floor next to me where I played with the spoon she had been using to add water to the dough. Let him do it, she thought. This was all his idea anyway. But guilt gnawed at her heart. the knowledge that she was not being a proper wife. And then a little farther down, he starts sweeping the floor, and another child says, "Ma, why is Bapu sweeping the floor?" Ma turned around. Bapu was crouched at the far end of the room, brushing the floor with the straw hand broom. Ma rushed to him as a shout escaped her. "No!" It was only after she had pulled the broom from him and Bapu had teetered for an instant from the force of the gesture that, standing so close to him, she caught the sadness and surprise on his face. Unable to look him in the eye, she swept the floor furiously, her own eyes filling with tears. She had let her husband, our father, the dance master, squat on the floor with a broom. This was so interesting to me because there's a great deal in this book that has to do with the roles of men and women, and Girija, part of her story is her quiet rebellion around the fate of their daughter Adhira. And yet here is this wonderful scene where she very much has pride in her woman's role and what the different role is for the woman and the man. And I just thought that was so interesting. And I wondered if you could talk about depicting women's issues in an historical context.
Sure. So here's the thing. I mean, the further back you go in history, the more you encounter these types of situations where, well, sometimes you don't have to go that far back in history, where women, you know, really had prescribed roles, roles prescribed by society and prescribed in particular by male society, but often by female society as well, and didn't have the freedoms to, you know, rebel against it.
Sure.
Or if they did, they would probably worsen their circumstances. But I feel like there's a certain universality to feelings, and I felt like in that situation where this little girl, Girija's youngest daughter, was being really pushed onto this path primarily by her father, because mm-hmm. Girija is not a Devadasi, and mm-hmm. so that's where there's this little loophole where Girija thought that there might be a way for her daughter to avoid this fate because she wasn't born into it. Mm-hmm. And this is a place in time and history where that kind of thing really ruled society. You know, you were born into a certain role or a certain caste or a certain place, and there was not really any changing that. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, Mahendra, the older son, tries to change for himself. He tries to become a warrior, mm-hmm. and it doesn't end up fantastically for him, not to give anything away. But I did feel like Girija would probably, even, you know, back then, want something more or something better for her child. I think that's a fairly natural, universal feeling.
Yes,
and so I had to rely on to a certain extent on just what I felt was human nature, as opposed to history. And I had a whole conversation with somebody about whether Girija was too quote unquote feminist for her times, and you know, I guess that's a question of opinion. But she has her own ideas, and in her own ways she tries to act upon them. But she's still also very respectful of her husband, and truly respectful of her husband and of what he does, and not wanting to upset that.
Right. Yeah, and I thought you did a really good job of depicting women in this book as having opinions and having an ability to question, even if they didn't necessarily always have an ability to stand up against something that they didn't believe in. And I thought that that was a very believable way to present women in this historical context.
Good. That's what I was going for.
Now, this may or may not be sort of related, but in your bio on your website, or not your bio, but in part of your website, you talk about your willingness to talk about certain what you call controversial terms, and one of them is women's fiction, the term women's fiction. And I saw this and I smiled because I've actually had discussions with friends about what women's fiction means and what it, you know. I just wondered what your take is on the term women's fiction.
I don't know. I mean, all these terms, literary fiction, genre fiction, women's fiction, I kind of rebel against categories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of, and I always, I realize I always have, I did this multidisciplinary major as in, when I was in undergrad, I took classes in 12 different departments and I put together my own sort of thing, which was fairly easy to do, so I went to Brown. And, and then, you know, even in graduate school, I became an urban planner, which brings together a lot of different disciplines, and is not just one thing. And, I'm half Indian and I'm half American and I grew up in France. And so I think I've always had this perspective that something can be many things and that's okay. You don't have to choose. You know, I don't have to choose whether my book is it literary fiction? Is it historical fiction? Is it women's fiction? Is it book club fiction? It is what it is. And right. I mean, yes, I think a lot of women will enjoy it, but I've had men, you know, tell me really nice positive things about their experience of reading the book as well. You know, women do a large majority of the fiction reading and the fiction buying. So so I tend to not try, I try not to pay attention to these terms. Unfortunately, as an author, one has to, because you have to think about how you're marketing your book and where bookstores are placing it on their bookshelf. And, you know, I think my book is women's fiction. I think it's literary fiction. I think it's multicultural fiction. I think it's historical fiction. But I have my own sort of definitions of what those are, or my own lack of definitions, perhaps I should say. Whereas for some people, I mean, for example, the term historical fiction conjures up certain ideas, I think, in people's minds that doesn't include 16th century India.
Right.
You know,
although that's amplified in recent years, I think.
But yeah.
I think historical fiction used to always sort of mean war, right?
Right, or it meant war, always, or it meant fiction set at certain times, Tudors, Victorians, World
right.
War II.
Right.
Very
right.
Western, you know, Western Hemisphere focused.
Yes.
But, you know, life was going on in other parts of the world at the same time. So, and similarly, women's fiction, I think for some people, will conjure up, you know, women sipping wine at a book club and talking about, I don't know, real estate. I don't know. And so that's the thing. That's why I don't really like the terms that much, because they mean different things to different people.
Well, and I think that they tend to become very peg-holed, you know, like, oh,
they
so
do.
The woman, so it's written by a woman, so it's women fiction, women's fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The characters are women, so it's women's fiction. The
right.
readers will
it
be
involves
women,
dance.
So it's,
right.
Whatever, and it's just like, no, you know, I'm sorry. Is Annie Proulx women's fiction? I don't think so.
Yeah, and then there's also this idea, I mean, I think it's there, this unspoken assumption that, you know, women's fiction is therefore not as serious.
Right, yes.
Which is nonsense.
Right, exactly. Let's see. Now, the book has been shortlisted for a couple of really nice prizes, the 2016 William Saroyan International Prize for Writing
mm-hmm.
and a 2015 Chaucer Award for Historical Fiction. Mm-hmm. Were you surprised by these announcements? Did you know you'd been nominated? How did that come about?
I was surprised to be shortlisted. I did know that my book was in the running.
Okay.
They haven't announced the winners yet for the Saroyan one. I think they announced it this summer. Regardless of the outcome, I get to say that it was shortlisted, which it was.
Yeah,
so there's that.
Nice.
That's always a nice thing.
Now,
is
that nomination process something that the publisher does, or how does that work?
So it's a surprising thing I learned in this world of being a published author, is that a large majority of the prizes, you can submit your own book.
Okay, okay.
Very few of them require a publisher to do so.
Okay.
But you know, sometimes it means sending in 8 copies and some letter and this sort of a process.
Yeah.
And knowing when the dates are and the deadlines and kind of keeping track of that, honestly, I think is more challenging than writing the book sometimes.
Yeah, well, I had a question for you about marketing. You and I actually met online through a women's writing forum, and we talked about marketing, which is it's not a skill that always comes easily to writers
mm-hmm.
who are, I think, you know, the stereotype is that the writer is sort of creative and in his or her head, and the publisher always handled the marketing, but it's not so much true anymore.
No.
And you do, I think, a fantastic job at marketing from what I see. And I just wondered if you can talk about creating your book's marketing plan and how mm-hmm. much help did you have from your publisher and other resources?
So I went with a fairly small and at the time quite new publisher. Mm-hmm. She Writes Press, mm-hmm. with whom I've been quite happy. But because they were on the smaller side and newer side, at the time, this has changed now because they've added on some more services. But at the time, they really did very little in terms of promotion, and they highly recommended that one hire one's own publicist.
Okay.
And I hired a publicist for a short time, but since it was coming out of my own pocket, I couldn't, you know, really do a
Keep
very snazzy, jazzy thing. But I felt fairly confident in my ability, at least regionally, sort of in the New England area where I've been based for quite a while. I have a fairly big network and sort of plugged into the literary community and the Indian community and the dance community. So, but a lot of my focus has been on capitalizing on the unique, one of the unique aspects of my book, which is the whole dance angle. And I have done, I just counted, I've done 50 events.
Wow.
Well, the book has been out about 18 months. But I've done about 50 events, all of which include some element of dance. So when I do a reading, for example, I incorporate dance movements. So I don't read from the book itself. I have printed pages because I need to put them down on a podium or something. And then I do the arm and hand motions that bring to life the passages I'm reading. And then if I have a little longer time, depends on the event and the venue, et cetera. But in many of them, specifically in libraries, for example, where I have more time and space, I will do a dance demo. And I'll dance one of the stories that comes up in the book. And people have really appreciated that. I'll sometimes even bring homemade chai and samosas and just create an experience. My idea is, you know, anybody can read from a book. And
yeah.
So I'd like to give the audience something different and unique that they can't otherwise get, and make it more of a whole sort of sensory experience. So mm-hmm. that means that, you know, I can't travel around doing that everywhere, but I do feel like the personal presence and bringing in the dance and that kind of thing has been great.
Okay. So you are a co-founder of the Chandham Institute of Kathak Dance, or Chandika.
Mm-hmm,
I wondered if you would like to talk about this group at all.
Sure. So that when I came back from that trip in India and I started studying Kathak, I joined a class and I befriended the teacher and learned that she had been interested for a while in having a nonprofit organization rather than simply being, not that it's simple, but rather than being a teacher with her students in a rented studio, she had a vision of something much larger where she could go into schools and universities
mm-hmm.
and do outreach programs and go to bring in visiting artists and that kind of thing, also because there's this unique aspect of Kathak, which is it's the only dance from India, classical dance, that melds both Hindu and Muslim traditions and aesthetics, because it was present in North India, which, as I mentioned, was mm-hmm. ended up being overtaken by what became the Mughal Empire and highly influenced then by Persian dance. So there's a lot of fascinating cultural, historical, and of course dance, you know, technique-wise things to expose people to. So, but she wasn't sure how to go about doing this, and it was 2001, 2002. I was working as a freelance urban planner, project manager. I had one project end, and I was sort of between projects. It was a time where there were a lot of layoffs in certain industries, and a couple of other students had some time on their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And this was before I had children, so it's hard to remember having time on my hands. But
yeah.
Apparently I did. And So it put, a few of us decided, you know, we're going to do this. And we spent a good amount of time really thinking about what we wanted the mission and values of the nonprofit to be, and building a website and doing the articles of incorporation and figuring out how to start a board of directors and all this stuff. And we filed for nonprofit status and did all the paperwork and got the thing going in 2002.
Okay.
We started off with about 20, 25 students, and now we have, I think, 150 or so.
Wow.
In various different locations, children, adults. We have a great performing youth ensemble with some really strong teens who started out as kids. And
performing dancers or performing musicians?
Performing dancers. Okay. Performing dancers. And we do now, we've done a lot of outreach programs in schools and all the things that we wanted to do, collaborating with the Boston Children's Museum or the Peabody Essex Museum, which has a great South Asian collection. And I'm in talks with the Museum of Fine Arts to do a project there. So that's been wonderful, you know, because then we could solicit donations and just have a presence as an organization.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah, it sounds like a wonderful, wonderful. The whole dance thing, it just sounds like it's so much fun and such a community, too.
It is. It is. Yeah, it's been fantastic. For about 7 years or so, I taught some of the kids' classes. I don't do that right now, but I love doing that as well.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about Faint Promise of Rain. Your characters are wonderfully drawn, and they are full of desire and conflict. And one that you mentioned before is Mahendra, who is Adhira's brother. And his father expects him to become a dancer, but as you said before, he wants to be a warrior. I wonder if just a little bit about developing character and maybe a little insight into what it was like to write his character.
Sure. Well, so Mahendra is, you know, when the story starts, he's about 14. And again, I think there's a certain universality to 14-year-old boys.
Yeah.
You know, they think they're grown up, and there's a certain maybe arrogance or self, you know, overinflated self-confidence or some rebellion against parents and expected behavior and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually came fairly easily to me, even though I am, you know, have never been a 14-year-old boy, but I felt like it was not a struggle to put him together.
Yeah.
And I wanted him, you know, but I also, he's a good kid at heart, and he's trying to protect his sister in the way that makes sense to him. And he's decided, you know, we can't just stand around here dancing. We need to do something more, and we need to fight these invaders.
I thought you did a really good job of depicting him as a 14-year-old boy, but also as at the point at which he starts to understand what his choices have created. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give anything away, but you know, there's like quite a story arc just to Mahendra, which I think is a nice thing to have within the novel. So, let's see. What have you read lately, maybe, that you would recommend to listeners? Have you read any books that you would?
I don't have nearly as much reading time as I used to or as I would like, but a couple of books I would recommend. So there's this lovely Sri Lankan author named Naomi Munawira, and I'm going to spell that. It's Munaweera. Naomi Munawira, and her second book just came out called What Lies Beneath, and I have not read it yet, although it's getting great reviews. But her first one, called Island of a Thousand Mirrors, it's a short little book, but very powerful. It takes place in Sri Lanka during the civil war there, and it's a bit of a difficult book, but it's beautiful. It's incredibly well written, and it really sort of gets to you. I highly recommend that and her second book, even though I haven't read it. I'm confident in recommending it as well. And a completely different, but a book that I felt did great things with language and character is Marie-Hélène Bertineau's 2 a.m. at the Cat's Pajamas, which is just one of the best titles ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's called 2 a.m. at the Cat's Pajamas, and the 2 is the number 2, in case you're looking for it.
Yeah, okay.
And the Cat's Pajamas is a jazz club, actually.
Oh, awesome.
I felt like so many of her sentences were so exquisitely constructed. It's clearly a book where every single word has a role. And the characters are pretty quirky. And one of the main characters is a 9-year-old girl who wants to be a jazz singer. And so there is also an element of, you know, arts and music in that one.
Yeah.
So these two are quite different, but they were both great reads.
Okay, wonderful. Well, okay, I have one last question for you. I thought you did a fine job of describing the dances, and I think that describing other forms of art on the page, dance, music, visual art, it can be so difficult to describe it well.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you can offer advice for listeners who might be writers about depicting art on the page when you're writing.
I think if you're going to depict art on the page, I think you need to try your hand at that art. And it doesn't mean, you know, dedicating your life to this whole other art because you're already a writer.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it means trying it out. I think if you're depicting, you know, painting, just play around with paint. Get a feel for how it feels like, the texture, the colors, what it looks like sort of glistening on the canvas, the threads of the lines of the paint brushes, try out different paint brushes. And, you know, you're probably not going to create a work of high art, or maybe you are. Maybe you'll discover something about yourself.
Maybe you'll give up writing.
But yeah, maybe. But I think that you need to have some form of personal experience with it, and you'll discover ways to describe things or things that you want to describe that you wouldn't have otherwise. You know, with music, I have in my second book that I'm working on now, I have a character who's a secondary character but still important, and he's a musician, and he plays an instrument that I'm not about to pick up and start playing. It's very complicated. It's called the sarangi. But I've certainly been listening to a ton of it, listening to sarangi music, and listening to it while not also doing something else, but just actually sitting and listening and thinking about what it evokes and what images it evokes or what feelings it evokes. So, you know, with dance, you can go take an introductory beginner dance class and whatever it is, or if for some reason physically you can't, you can at least go sit in the studio, watch people, talk to people who are doing it. So yeah, I'd say try to gain as close a first-hand experience as you can, even if it's just sort of symbolic.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. The name of the book is Faint Promise of Rain by Anjali Mitter-Duva, published by She Writes Press. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. I always like discussing my book. Thank you for sharing it.
That, again, was a conversation with Anjali Mitter-Duva. You can learn more about her work at her website, anjalimitterduva.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Anjali Mitter-Duva. The prompt she suggests comes from the writer Barbara O'Neill, who Anjali says was inspired to come up with it after watching 1 Second Every Day videos. Call it the 1 Minute Detail. Set a timer for 1 minute and write what is happening right now, wherever you are. Begin with the words, "in this moment." Include as much detail as you can and write for the full minute. This prompt helps to get you in the habit of observing and noticing detail. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. And by Main Street Landing, providing daily rental space for events, meetings, conferences, and parties. Visit mainstreetlanding.com for more information, or come on down to the Burlington waterfront. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host Gary's website is GaryLeeMiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that The Radiator exists thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at bigheavyworld.com. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book, which airs at 2 o'clock every Monday on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.